Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president, CEO, and political observer Alan Shartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Tuesday, Joe Donahue and Alan Shartok were joined by investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
So the U.S. Capitol Police's failure to share intelligence internally crippled its response to the January 6th attack. This, according to a formal official. A former senior official in the U.S. Capitol Police accused two of the department's top officials of failing to properly share vital intelligence in the days ahead of the January 6th insurrection, crippling the response to the attack. In a blistering letter to Congress, the former official claims that Assistant Capitol Police Chief Yogananda Pittman and Acting Assistant Chief Sean Gallagher received an intelligence report on December 21st that had specific warnings and information about a potential riot, similar to a report that the FBI later provided to the department on January 5th, just a day before. In the 16-page letter dated September 28th, the former official claims that Pittman and Gallagher deliberately never shared this December intelligence report with other department officials or used it to update security assessments provided to Capitol Police officers. Sharing that information, the former official alleges, could have, quote, changed the paradigm of that day and would have provided the documentation needed to support securing the National Guard and other allied agency manpower for January 6th. It also would have provided the intelligence needed to procure hard gear and other weapons. A pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol on January 6th, of course, to try and stop the counting of the Electoral College votes affirming President Biden's win. And the worst attack on the seat of democracy since the War of 1812, four people died, and an officer who had been sprayed with powerful chemical irritant, Brian Sicknick, suffered a stroke and died the following day. Some 140 members of law enforcement were injured as rioters attacked them, wielding flagpoles, baseball bats, stun guns, bear spray, and pepper spray. So, Alan, yeah. I don't even know what to make of this as far as you know what's coming. You have a report and you bury it. Why would you do that?
Well, first of all, if it's true, it is what the Yiddish word would be, schandal. It's a shame. You know, it's wrong. If it's true, I must say I was extraordinarily puzzled as I was sitting there watching the whole thing, Joe, as I think you may have been, as the protesters filed in past a lot of the security guards, a lot of the people who were guarding the place. And there wasn't, you know, some of them did their jobs all right and put themselves into great danger. But some of them just sort of stood there almost as if they were holding the door. So a lot of it didn't compute for me at the time. If it is true that they knew and they didn't tell anybody within their own system, that really would be a terrible thing.
And I guess, Rosemary, it's hard not to be conspiratorial when you think of information like this, that mm-hmm. they knew and someone was telling them not to share that information.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a matter of training or fixing procedure, which is how the Capitol Police seem to be dealing with it. Oh, yes, we've taken all the recommendations that came out after January 6th. This is like basic. You hear that there's going to be a riot, you kind of spread the word. That seems basic. And as I've maintained all along, this is all a criminal matter. I do not understand why this is not something the Department of Justice is looking into, if indeed they aren't. They don't appear to be. So hence my criticism. Why this is a congressional hearing, why the letter, a secret letter to a congressional committee, why, if this is true, these people deserve more than to lose their job. They deserve criminal charges, and we are not seeing them. We have not gotten to the bottom of whether there were any Capitol Police involved in the planning and the execution of this attempted coup.
Mike Spain, in the days following September 6th, there were many people that were brought up to Capitol Hill to be questioned, including members of the Capitol Police and top-ranking members of the Capitol Police. And there were questions even then. This sort of goes to emphasize that of what we knew and what we didn't know.
Yeah. First of all, I want to say I do agree with Rosemary. This, again, underscores how this should be a criminal investigation. Was this incompetence or was it something much worse? And that I think the public needs to know the answers to that. The members of Congress need to know answers to that. And that won't happen, even though I think that the special committee, the select committee in the House of Representatives is doing a very balanced, fair job investigating the events of January 6th, it will be regarded as a partisan view. That's why an independent Department of Justice inquest needs to be done to find out if there was any orders from the top. I mean, it's a horrible suggestion that this is more than incompetence, but it's either horrible incompetence or something much worse.
Well, what other rational answer would there be to, I mean, I guess incompetence, but that you have this information and you don't do anything with it and you don't share anything with it? I mean, it's hard to be, for want of a better term, charitable, right, Alan? I mean,
well,
charitable.
I think Mike is hinting at something here. And that is, maybe some of these people were in on it.
Right.
I mean, if they were in on it, and then it really, as Rosemary says, becomes a terrible criminal problem and needs to be dealt with that way. It smells like incompetence to me, but you never know.
J.P. Miller.
Well, there were, of course, police officers that non-uniform police officers that did participate in the riot. But when I read this, I think of the obvious need for an independent commission similar to the 9/11 commission report made up of both Democrats and Republicans. Of course, the Republicans in Congress blocked the potential for an independent commission. But you know, there are kind of two narratives in the country. If you ask Republicans what happened on January 6th, or a lot of Republicans, they'll say, well, security failed and there should have been more security. And you ask Democrats, they say, well, Trump incited a riot and you have to blame Trump. And the answer is, of course, both of those are correct. There is a huge security failure that we need to understand and need to investigate. And of course, need to understand, more how exactly Trump did this. And of course, the communications among his supporters in the weeks leading up to it on Facebook, on other social networks. I watched part of the HBO documentary on QAnon by Colin Hoback and listened to an interview of his. And it's amazing how much, you know, I think of myself as a pretty informed person. And there's so much about this January 6th insurrection and riot that we, I think, as a whole, don't yet know about.
You know, what I don't get, Joe and group, is the fact that this president, ex-president, stood up there and he said, get up there and fight like hell and I'm going with you. You don't have to go much further than that. And somehow, as usual, he ends up getting some modicum of protection. Public protection, or maybe it's his claim of some kind of crazy immunity, but he's the one who did it. Or he's the one who done it.
And of course, another part of this story, the White House has informed the National Archives that it's not asserting executive privilege on an initial batch of documents related to the January 6th violence at the Capitol, which paves the way for the archives to share the documents with the House committee investigating the attempted insurrection. President Trump has called on Biden not to share those documents, which, I mean, doesn't that doesn't that give a twinge of guilt, or not guilt, but of
guiltiness?
Thank you. Yes, that's right. Guiltiness.
Good word.
Yeah, of wrongdoing, let's say.
Yeah.
Mike.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. What would you expect that he would openly allow his records to be handed over to the committee? He's just going to fight every step of the way. It's part of this counter narrative that Republicans have embraced, elected Republicans, people in the party who are party leaders.
Who are endangered.
Yeah, yes. Says
Mike Pence, for God's sakes, they had a noose outside for him, and he is playing the game. At the same time, he's being slugged by you-know-who.
Yeah. I mean, not enough Republicans are stepping forward and denouncing Trump and denouncing this painful narrative. And I even feel like we're feeding this narrative by talking about it so much, but we must talk about it and reveal it, and accountability has to be had. I think what JP said really stuck with me, that we're only scratching the surface. I mean, the book, I heard your interview, Joe, with Robert Costa, you know, about peril. And, you know, the Eastman memo that was revealed in that book, I don't think, and the New York Times had also reported that, I don't think that people have understood the gravity there, that they had a quote unquote justification for all of this, and to pull it all off, and how close it was, and how endangered our democracy was that day, and how it remains in danger unless we recognize that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't that long ago. Yeah. It was. Go ahead, Rosemary. I'm sorry.
I would say the awful truth of this is that they needed someone killed. Not a policeman. They needed a member of Congress hurt or killed in order for this to not be put, swept under the rug as it has been. One of the things, I'm not a big fan of this committee, but one of the things that has come out really strongly is how involved Trump was in fighting to overturn the election, aside from what happened on January 6th. That was like part of his idea. But his subversion, attempted subversion of the Department of Justice, his calls to state election officials, this is all coming out. It makes me want to impeach him again. And every Republican who voted against impeaching him ought to be hanging their heads right now in shame. If ever anyone deserved impeachment, it was Donald Trump.
But instead, they're doubling down. And just in the last 2 days, two names that have been up there holding the president's hand and saying, good for you, Steve Scalise, Chuck Grassley. This is all being rewritten before our eyes.
Rewritten is a good word. You listen to any media, broadcast media, or you read anything in a mainstream press, you read about the Grassley and Steve Scalise version of what happened on January 6th, and then you read the other version of what happened and what really happened, and they get equal play, and I think that confuses people. It is specious that the attention is even given to their narrative, except you have to expose them for the frauds that they are, and yet when you do, people don't seem to pay any attention to that.
I agree with you entirely, but I just go back to what Alan was saying, Mike. You know, it's hard to believe that. All you have to do is watch that tape. I mean, all you have to do is watch what happened. It wasn't like it was right there in front of us, right in front of God and everybody, as my mother used to say. You know, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's a big secret.
No, I'm bewildered by it. I always had believed that journalists would put forth the facts, people would see them, and they'd do the right thing. But right now, people are seeing two different things. They're looking at two different versions of reality, and one is not reality, one is bizarro reality, and that is the Steve Scalise, Chuck Grassley, and, you know, just about every other leading Republican out there. I mean, we need Republicans to step forward and say, this is wrong. I mean, Liz Cheney, who I don't agree with on so many things, I have so much regard and respect for her heroism on saying what is right and calling her colleagues to wake up.
And yet they're going to kick her out. Every indication is that those voters in that district are going to throw her out. You know, this is really much more than we can stand. And there's a very good chance that Donald Trump will be elected president another time. No, says everybody, putting their hands over their ears. And yet, the polls are showing it. Iowa is showing it. What has come to this country?
Alan is right. Not only is Trump poised to win back the White House should he choose to run, or one of his minions, if it is they, but also Republicans are well likely to take back the House and the Senate, which would be the worst nightmare, a Trump government unified. And it is not just the polls, which, as you know, I don't trust or really listen to anymore. It's analysis of the data of where voters are. And Democrats are concentrated in cities, and our electoral college is set up so that you need to be in rural areas and spread out over red states. The Democrats would have to get people who are not voting for them now to vote, and get places that have never gone Democratic to go Democratic in order to bring this about. It looks disastrous. And this was a big report on examining data in the Washington Post by Ezra Klein this weekend. I recommend it, but, you know, have your Pepto-Bismol nearby while you're reading.
Well, a big part of that too, wasn't it, Rosemary, in my reading of the report, and I believe it was the same one that you're referring to, was that where Biden is really taking a hit is in the pandemic and the response to the pandemic among Democrats, that he would have a much firmer hand and grasp on that issue.
Yeah, as we have discussed, I think, many times on this program, he gambled it all, which we were generally, I still am, approving of, that the biggest problem in America was getting a pandemic under control. He thought he had a way forward. It looked like he did with the vaccine. And then there's been resistance and Republican pushback and craziness on the right-wing radio and talk shows and television. And he has not succeeded. Even in New York, a decidedly blue state, the rate of vaccination is, 56%, I think, is the latest number. That's not good. So what does he have to point to as, look, you made me president, look what I did for you? And to me, it seems like it's time to pull out all the stops. We've got one more year with Democratic control of government. So they've got to do away with the filibuster. They have to change voting rights, voting repression laws. They have to probably give statehood to Washington, D.C. and maybe Puerto Rico. The Democrats either act now, and this is in this report, I'm not making this up, they either act now or they're out of power for the next 10 years or longer.
J.P. Miller.
I, too, read that article by Ezra Klein in the New York Times this weekend, and I found it fascinating as well. And I don't know that, you know, what you're prescribing, Rosemary, might be seen by some as like a power grab on the way out, because they know that they're going to lose. They're going to, you know, try and change the rules on the
Correct.
Way out.
Correct.
I would.
That is what I'm.
Right. I would think more about, you know, it's pretty simple what this pollster says, and that is that Democrats should message on where they are strong, which is populism, taxing the rich. They should focus on those issues and not allow the focus to be on issues that are less popular in swing states, like the political correct issues that young Democratic staffers tend to focus on. That's kind of the crux of the article and what they say. But it is a very sobering read by Ezra Klein. And going back for just a second to January 6th, I think a lot of us view that as a horrible event and hopefully something that will never, ever be able to happen again. But if you look at what is happening amongst the Republican Party, and when some folks say, you know, Republicans should stand up to Trump, Republicans that stand up to Trump and disagree with Trump, they're not Republicans anymore. Trump owns the Republican Party. The Republican Party is Trump, and he is the Republican Party. And what I really fear about January 6th is that was kind of a precursor to something that could be bigger, that could be coming. And next time, instead of 50,000 nut jobs in D.C., there could be 500,000.
J.P. Miller on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, October 12th. Please note, as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Thursday, October 14th, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok were joined by Cajos City Director of Operations, Teresa Bourgeois, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Icarius-Kelly, and Corporate Attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan.
I want to talk about the Biden administration's plan for wind farms along nearly the entire U.S. coastline. The Interior Secretary announced that the agency will formally begin the process of identifying federal waters to lease to wind developers by 2025. Speaking at a wind power industry conference in Boston, the secretary said that the agency will begin to identify and demarcate and hope to eventually lease federal waters in the Gulf of Mexico, Gulf of Maine, and off the coast of the Mid-Atlantic states, North Carolina and South Carolina, California and Oregon to wind power developers by 2025. The announcement comes months after the Biden administration approved the nation's first major commercial offshore wind farm off the coast of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, and began reviewing a dozen other potential offshore wind projects along the East Coast. Alan.
Well, I love the idea that they went to Martha's Vineyard first. That will certainly PO some of the people who see that as the ultimate sanctuary of, you know, wealth and privilege. And, you know, so, I mean, I don't want to start a fight there, but as you all know, I'm a bit of a Fire Islander. And I'd like to see the same thing happening there. Look, the way that we're going to save ourselves is by having energy production that comes from something that is as harmless as that is, in contradistinction to the, my favorite word, to the way in which we produce energy now, the fossil fuels. So I love it. I think it's great. I don't think there's any negative side to it. And Roselle and I were riding along the other day, and we saw one of these giant things. I think it was off the I-90. In Massachusetts, it was beautiful. It was like looking into the fire. You know, you just couldn't stop looking at it.
Vera?
Yeah, so I want to add a comparative perspective because obviously, as people might suspect, I'm also in favor of wind power. The reason I say it, because I've visited wind power sites in Germany. They're very common in Germany, and then, you know, Netherlands, the UK, Norway. You have them set up on the North Sea and Baltic Sea. What you do is extensive studies to make sure it doesn't affect the tourism industry. It doesn't affect if there are any archaeological site underground in the water. And so on. Germany has done this for many, many years, over a decade. We now have in Germany 1/4 of our power generated by wind turbines. The essential issue is that way you can replace fossil fuels and obviously also nuclear power, which has been the fundamental issue in Germany, because Germany ended nuclear power production in its own country. And so here we are looking at dramatic changes within the sort of Central European context in terms of power production through the wind turbines. What's interesting is that most of the surrounding countries are also pursuing the same strategy. It was initially controversial because investments were more expensive, the costs have come down. Then obviously you have to consider coastal animal life. Fisheries tend to be opposed to some of the fishing industry tends to be opposed, and tourism tends to be opposed if the sites selected are problematic for them. That again has to be negotiated and studied and researched. So the United States is behind in terms of pursuing wind turbines, but it is a very good option to go forward. It will help create a new dynamic industry, and obviously for a number of reasons I'm in favor of it.
Rich?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with everything Vera said. My understanding, and I've always said this, you know, renewables, alternative sources of power, you know, the venture capitalists, the entrepreneurs, you know, they're all about that. You know, there's just a huge amount of innovation and money that's going on. My understanding, and I'm not an expert on anything, but not this. My understanding is that one of the delays, one of the reasons why the United States is behind is once you've kind of gotten freed up the land, I think there's still a fairly lengthy process, you know, kind of your typical environmental, you know, whether it's a CEQA process or there's a long process to getting all of the permits you need, and both from an environmental and regulatory standpoint, as well as kind of the surrounding, you know, the surrounding neighbors and you know, the effects on them. And that's been one of the delays that has kind of slowed things down in the United States. I don't know if this latest proposal also includes kind of ways of short-circuiting some of those delays. I don't know if it's that far along yet or not.
Teresa.
I think the best news here is that this administration is intensely focusing on renewable energy options, setting some very firm goals, and then working it across departments, agencies, and so on and so forth, which may seem obvious, but I think there had been a lot of stovepiping before, and so this is, based on what I read, you know, this is some breakthrough in that regard. I don't know enough about the environmental impacts of wind farms and oceans to really speak on this specifically, but I do know that we need to do much, much more with renewables. And I know I've spent the last year and a half for the city of Cahoos working on a project which will be the first of its kind in the country on floating solar and floating solar panels on a human-made water reservoir, so you don't have to worry about disrupting natural resource. It's a human-made water reservoir. And there's a national study from a DOE-funded organization that says, you know, there are 24,000 of these around the country, and they could generate 10% of our electric energy needs with clean power if we tap just these floating solar. So I can imagine the capacity for wind farms. You'd much rather, I think, a wind farm than an oil rig out in the ocean. But I do think, as Rich points to, there's a lot of steps in this process. But there also is potential for enormous other innovation. I worked with a professor when I worked at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Her name is Dr. Anna Dyson. She's now at Yale. But she's looking at the design of building envelopes and could windows and buildings become, you know, essentially solar panels. So you don't have to go to these offshore farms or use up farmland. The exciting thing is I think that all of these areas will be an acceleration of innovation, of investment to find new ways. And then just to get a little bit more wonky on this, the other piece of this, though, that has to be dealt with is the electric grid, the power grid, and its capacity, carrying capacity. It's really complicated. It's going to need a lot of work, and it needs to be done to take advantage of these renewables.
Yeah, I'd let me just second that as well. It's almost like with a lot of the renewables, the generation is less of the issue. It's the storage and the distribution. You know, particularly, you know, on the solar side, but you know, also with wind, so you see a lot of the visible innovation is on the generation, actually generating the power, but storing it and then distributing it, and with the increasing emphasis on electricity, you know, electric vehicles and everything like and things like that, and the increasing awareness of the fragility of the grid, I think that could be one of the choke points. You know, I think the other political choke point here is it'll be interesting to see when these projects get far enough along to where they're now seeking environmental approval, and then you might have two opposed, two political groups kind of opposing each other who are usually on the same side, right? So you're going to have the renewable people now being opposed to the environmental people and see kind of how, you know, who threads that needle. But it's a real good first step. We'll see where it goes.
So maybe, Rich, I think it's important to be having the discussion, though,
and to begin to work out those things and see if there are other ways, like, you know, floating solar on municipal, water bodies where it's, you know, these are human made, so you don't have these environmental issues. Where are the innovations? But this connection to the grid, someone at the state agency NYSERDA told us, you know, those are where good ideas go to die, to try to make that connection. And it's true, it's complicated, but it needs to be figured out. And the great news is that, and this is where we need to get back to the infrastructure bill and the other bills that are pending in the Congress, there's an awful lot of resources. I've read the Department of Energy funding bill, tremendous support in there to drive, to accelerate getting answers to these questions, because we absolutely need them.
I agree 100% with what Teresa said. It was very, very similar in a comparative case with Germany. Just the same arguments were made in Germany, and infrastructure bills were approved, and the grid connection was established. So it can be done. We have the technology if we get infrastructure bills through. That was it.
I'll take agreement when we can get it. Barbara says, title, T-I-D-A-L. Free, dependable, predictable, eternal movement of trillions of tons of seawater twice a day. Harness this, and who needs a windmill? That is from Barbara. Then, on the issue
Joe,
of... Yes?
Joe, if I could have the floor for just one moment here. We're getting a lot of letters about Rich. Let me just say, as the guy who thought up the round table and the panel, the idea of a panel is that you get different ideas. Now, 76 million, something like that, 73 million people voted for Donald Trump. If this is to be a true panel, you got to hear what the other guys have to say. I don't agree with much of what Rich says, and yet we value him, and we always ask him to be on. He's not on, not because of us, but because of him. And the more he's on, the better I like it, frankly, because I do believe that these issues and what people are thinking about them and why they're thinking about them are so important. And that's all I got to say.
All right.
Can I say something on tidal energy? I think tidal wave energy is a fantastic future opportunity. We do not have all of the technology yet. It's up and coming, and I think it's exactly right. It's significantly more reliable than both wind and sun energy. So that's where the future is, but it's not exactly fully operational at the moment.
Rich works a lot on innovation, but I think we are, once there's an intense focus on clean energy, there's just enormous potential for an extraordinary acceleration of innovation in these areas, which will create jobs, it will create new wealth, it creates new opportunity. It's just, we are talking with the community colleges and others about what's the pipeline for workers, and we're talking with our school district for these clean energy jobs and innovation, and it's just enormous, whether it's tidal, solar, floating, whatever. There's so much opportunity. Rich, you work with a lot of innovation. You could probably speak better to this, right?
I agree. I think that you said it exactly right. Tidal itself is tough just because it's hard to build the plants. It's hard to find a place to build them, and then it's hard to build them and it's a force that's really powerful but really slow, and then I think there's some unknowns. There's some unknowns about the effect on sea life and things like that are just legit difficult issues. I think when it comes to renewables and innovation, one of the things we've seen is once you can get a renewable energy idea into the everyday economy, you build a lot around that. And I think the best example is electric vehicles, and the amount of innovation that I see, even here in Albany, in, you know, upstate New York, USA, the amount of innovation that is going on around things that support electric vehicles. And it's not just, you know, making the cars and making the batteries and the energy storage. It's the charging stations, and it's the mapping, and it's the, you know, putting together the locations for people trying to find stations. There's so many the people with the company in Syracuse that does the portable, you know, basically extra battery. There's so much that gets built around it once something becomes synthesized into the economy, and that's what you're trying to see. And so once you actually get, you know, to our point before, once you actually get wind farms, for example, on the grid, and people are building software and equipment around that's when things really take off. But, you know, it's hard. Believe me, there's nobody standing in the way of it, because, you know, the environment, you know, the greenies all love it, and the capitalists all love it, and it's just hard to do, you know. It's definitely the way to go.
Let's go to some letters that we have on our topic of renewables and wind power, and then we'll move on to other subjects. Jim says, I wish those who are in favor of huge wind turbines and massive solar farms would realize how they will negatively impact only those who live in the scenic rural areas of our country. Apparently, the rural folk don't matter so much. These structures are hardly harmless, and yes, there are, in fact, lots of negative downsides beyond destroying scenic vistas and cutting down vast swaths of carbon-eating forests to install solar farms. There is 20-megawatt solar farm being installed on a hillside near our lakeside cabin, and to say it is not pretty is being kind. Renewables are simply not all they are cracked up to be. That is a perspective from Jim. We go to John, who says, I am all for developing alternate sources of energy production. At the same time, however, might we be working on diminishing the cause of the problem, our culture's overconsumption of all resources by an ever-booming, out-of-control population? Discourage large families, for instance, or excessive carbon-based travel. All right. You heard her.
Joe, can I?
Less sex. Go ahead. Yes.
But I do think the reason I mentioned this Professor Dyson I work with, who's wants us to rethink what we call the building envelope, windows, everything, because, you know, I thought that she really posed some important questions. Do you need these large solar farms? Do you need these large wind farms? Can you take the structures we have and essentially turn them into solar collectors? Or, you know, energy collectors in a different way. And I think that that's an important question to ask, because there is a lot of pressure being put on farmland. You see that in the newspaper stories in upstate New York. It's essential that we move toward renewables, but we have to be creative in the way that we do it and take into account, you know, the full life cycle impacts of these and you know, the way the good with the bad and see where the innovation is. But as Rich pointed out, the key to a lot of this, unlocking this, is storage. And we need a lot more innovation in storage. And that gets back to why we need to pass this infrastructure bill and this larger portions of this larger spending bill focused on clean energy, because we need to unlock those answers pretty quickly.
Betsy writes, Rich is wrong that there is no impediment from business over clean energy. There is plenty that stands in the way, and it's not the technologies. It's the energy companies and utilities. Good example is the fight over rooftop solar in Arizona, where the utilities actually stopped rooftop solar from connecting to the grid, essentially halting such projects in Arizona, where solar should be the dominant energy producer. James writes, I'm not an engineer, but it seems to me that the current electricity distribution model is backwards. Rather than having companies distribute electricity for a fee, shouldn't the ultimate goal be to have Hive input into the grid? In other words, every house, apartment complex, business have solar panels, wind, etc., to provide for their own use. and any extra fed back into the grid.
Yeah, and by the way, a lot of people are thinking about that idea as well. Obviously, you know, certainly there's lots of people with solar panels who are sending energy back onto the grid. But, you know, to Teresa's point, that the more you can do that kind of on a consumer individual basis, and, you know, maybe you have solar panels on your house, maybe you have some kind of, you know, windmill or something, you can people are looking at that as well, basically you supporting the grid rather than the grid supporting you. I will say that the letters demonstrate, you know, the kind of the difference of ideas on this, right? And all sincere, all, you know, it's all legit. But even in those few letters, it kind of stakes out, you know, the spectrum of views on this. It's difficult.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a wide swath, no question about it.
But the importance is that the conversation is now being had, right? We're talking through these issues, and that's how we get to some, you know, some solutions and some new innovations and such. And of course, as one of the writers mentioned, the one of the key things is to reduce consumption, right? To make our buildings as energy efficient as possible, to have more walkable cities. To rethink, you know, anyway, to rethink how we live, work, and play, to do it in a way that is as energy efficient as possible, and that the energy we are using is derived as much as possible from renewables is the key.
Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, October 14th. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel of the week in review after this. Listening to the Roundtable panel of the week in review, I'm Roundtable producer Sarah LaDuc. On Friday's show, Joe Donahue and Alan Shartok were joined by research professor and Stuart Rice honorary chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman. Former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, and lecturer and adjunct professor in communications for SUNY New Paltz and RPI, Terry Gibson.
We'll talk about Moderna. We didn't know where this was going to go. It seemed questionable even as of yesterday morning, but the FDA panel has recommended Moderna boosters for people 65 and older and adults at high risk of exposure or severe illness. An independent advisory panel to the FDA on Thursday unanimously recommended a booster dose of Moderna for people 65 and older and those at high risk. The recommendation mirrors the eligibility criteria for Pfizer, which was authorized in September. Nearly 70 million Americans have been fully vaccinated with the Moderna vaccine, and millions of them would be eligible for a follow-up dose 6 months after vaccination if the agency authorizes the extra shot, which would be half the dose initially given. So my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't want to give false information, but I think the Pfizer booster is a full dose, and I think the Moderna is a half dose.
Now, I don't want to get into trouble with you because you are my, you know, idol when it comes to all of this stuff, but I have to say I have no idea.
Yeah, I think I read that. But
I know I got the Pfizer booster.
As did I.
Yeah.
And I think when I did, it was a full dose, was my understanding. Anyway, the recommendation will now be considered by FDA officials who are expected to reach a decision on the Moderna booster within days. An advisory committee to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that makes recommendations on how vaccines should be used is scheduled to meet on Wednesday. Judith Enck.
Well, I think this is good news, and I urge everyone, if they are eligible, to get the booster shot. I guess we're just waiting today to see what happens with Johnson & Johnson. I think it's reassuring that this 18 or 19 member panel voted unanimously. And it just seems like the responsible thing to do if you've got the option. I do think this has now become a pandemic of the unvaccinated. And I really salute Governor Hochul and other governors who have, and President Biden, who has supported mandatory vaccinations for healthcare workers, for first responders and others, because I think, you know, the data is quite clear that most people will not sacrifice their jobs in order to stay unvaccinated. I mean, the numbers from airlines that have required mandatory vaccinations, and, you know, it's a less than 1% of the staff that have opted to leave their jobs. I think it's unfortunate that some of the unions are pushing back on this, since I think unions were established years ago to protect public safety. But we still have, you know, we still have this huge problem of large numbers of people not being vaccinated, and therefore we don't have herd immunity, and therefore we are, you know, susceptible to another strain taking over, you know, our economy, our health, our lives. So I think this is encouraging news that now we've got Pfizer and Moderna with approvals for the boosters.
How could you have said to the Pfizer people, it's all right that you did it, you got the booster, and then turn around and say to the Moderna, no, you can't have it. And, you know, and everybody understands that if they got the Moderna shot, somebody's going to yell at them, you lose.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem so.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, let's look at the bright side of all of this. And, you know, let me just start by saying, yay, science. You know, I mean, think about, yay, science. You know, think about what's been happening and how accelerated all of this has been. And think about where we are compared to where we were a couple of years ago. You know, we understand much more about the disease. We actually have people, we actually have vaccines. When you get the disease, if you get the disease, we know more about how to treat it. You know, there's all kinds of good news on the horizon. You know, hopefully this will get to the point where we can treat it like we treat severe cases of the flu. You know, we understand it more. We're not as scared of it. It hasn't, you know, it doesn't so much change our ecosystem. So yay, science. Shall I say that again? Yay, science.
You make a good case.
You think about this FDA panel, they're doing what the thoughtful, important scientific thing is to do, is for the studies you have, which are not complete, because there's always more studies you can do with more populations, better evidence that the trends are really trends instead of a lot of noise. You know, they're kind of working through all those details. They're doing that despite the fact that, you know, whether you get vaccinated or not, or whether you wear a mask or not, has become a political thing, despite the fact that, you know, the government is shockingly a little dysfunctional. You know, they're doing it in spite of all of that. So, you know, I got the Moderna shot, and I'm just really happy that the time has come and we have some studies to actually give some advice about it. And as more studies come, we might give, you know, other advice about it. Maybe you need a whole shot. Maybe you need a shot in 2 months. I mean, studies will tell us those kinds of things. But, you know, yay science.
So let's go to the flip side of that. Not yay science, but just the flip side, which is what is happening. And Judith mentioned this about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So 15 million Americans received the J&J vaccine. And the confusing messages from the federal government keep coming. The FDA advisory panel, as Judith mentioned, is scheduled to vote today on whether J&J recipients should receive a booster shot. But the panel is not likely to vote on what seems to be the most relevant question. Should the booster shot come from one of the other vaccines? In other words, if you get a booster, it be Pfizer or Moderna, as opposed to a follow-up J&J shot. The scientific evidence increasingly suggests that the answer is yes, you should get a Pfizer or Moderna shot. Still, the FDA panel seems likely to duck the question and rule only on whether the J&J recipients should receive a J&J booster. It is the latest example of a recurring COVID problem. Again and again, government officials have chosen to follow pre-existing bureaucratic procedures, even when doing so has led to widespread public confusion and counterproductive behavior. Officials often defend this approach by saying they merely, get ready, Fran, follow the science. But that's not quite accurate. When there is a conflict between scientific evidence and bureaucratic protocols, science often takes a back seat. Fran, I will throw that to you.
Oh, good. I don't want to be piggy, but I do have an opinion about this. I know you're shocked, Joe.
I love that you have an opinion and that you're going to share it.
I mean, first of all, I think that it seems likely from a non-medical professional point of view that if you take a different approach, you get, remember your fourth grade education, you guys, the union of help rather than the intersection. So the question is, does getting a different kind of vaccine expand all the ways you can fight the disease, or does it only focus on the ways you can fight the disease that are common to both the vaccines that you've got? And that takes data, and that takes, trials, and that takes, people sort of signing up for both approaches and looking at the numbers. It may be, and I know they've done some studies on this in the UK. I don't know where else they've done studies on, and, maybe some of our enlightened readers will write letters about this. It would be great to hear. But it may be that there are not sufficient studies to actually know what's our best strategy. That's number one. Number two, and I'm sad to say this, is that when you make decisions about health and the medical profession, oftentimes commerce is in it. And, it may be that the questions that they're looking at, and I don't know who brought these questions to the FDA, if it's Johnson & Johnson, they want to sell more, vaccines. And so they may just be particularly interested in vaccines where a Johnson & Johnson booster is used to support the main Johnson & Johnson shot. And that I don't know and would love to be enlightened about. But you can't get away from commerce. That's one of the messy parts of the real world that we all struggle with.
Terry?
I guess when I sort through all the messaging on this, at the end of the day, it does seem to me that the people that receive the Johnson & Johnson shot will be eligible for a booster in the very, very near future, maybe in the coming weeks, and that they will be protected just like the rest of us that receive other vaccines. And I think that's the important aspect of it, regardless of how it is developing, which certainly has room for improvement. My bigger concern, and I think just as a nation our bigger concern globally as well, is that we have got to find a message that resonates with those who continue to resist getting vaccinated. Right. And it is amazing how far we have come scientifically and yet how challenging it continues to be to get so many people, even in the state of New York, vaccinated. And that is the real problem, because until we do that, we continue to have to live within this pandemic with all types of protocols like masking and social distancing and all the other things that could eventually come to an end if we could all get on the same page. And so that's where I want to see the government really focus. And they are trying, and they are getting better, but it is slow.
Judith.
Yeah, I totally agree with Terry. I mean, I think the booster information is so important, especially if you want to get the booster yourself. You need to understand, what your personal opportunities are here. But I'm a little concerned that much of the national media coverage has shifted to the boosters when we still have a significant number of people who refuse to get vaccinated, and not because of medical restraints. And I'm, you know, quite concerned that this is now kind of an ideological, political statement that unvaccinated, unmasked people are making. And it's the reason why, you know, people are still getting COVID. There are breakthrough infections. We're wearing masks everywhere. The supply chain is disrupted. There's a lot of suffering going on because of COVID. And we have to stay laser focused in trying to figure out how to get a higher vaccination rate. And it's not just a problem in Mississippi and Alabama. It is a problem in the Northeast. And we just cannot lose track of that. I don't have an answer. In October 2021, with such compelling information on why vaccinations work, I don't know how you reach people who think it's a political statement not to get vaccinated. And then I think this is all going to accelerate when children, you know, younger children are approved for vaccination, which I think is around the corner. And then the question of, you know, I know the LA school district and I think New York City school district has said once vaccines are approved for younger kids, they will be required to be vaccinated to come to the school. Well, imagine what those school board meetings are going to be like. So, you know, buckle up. We are nowhere close to solving this historic pandemic problem.
You know, Joe, it might be that, to Judith's point, it could be that when children are approved to get the vaccine, it could work the other way. It could be the thing that begins to help us get more people vaccinated, because we do have history on our side when it comes to requiring kids to get vaccinated. We know that that's mm-hmm. how we have fought off so many other cruel diseases and pandemics in the past. We have great evidence that that worked, and it's what has helped build our country for many, many, many years. So to all of a sudden now somehow make this vaccine an exception to that, I think it's going to be very difficult in many places. So it could be that once we have the ability to protect our children, there is just a greater rush to get it done and more people get vaccinated. I'm hoping that that might happen.
Terry Gibson on the Roundtable panel on Friday, October 15th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. Our music this week is Why Only One from Edgar Meyer and Chris Thiele's album Bass and Mandolin. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.